Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Tonight, we're taking a look at whether San Francisco should implement congestion pricing. 1 year after New York rolled out its congestion pricing program, the results appear mostly positive. But San Francisco is a very different city. So how might congestion pricing affect commutes, street safety, and downtown businesses here? We'll be opening the phone lines during that segment and want to hear your thoughts. Later in the hour, we'll hear from filmmaker Deborah Riley Draper, whose new documentary, Ratified, traces the legal, political, and deeply personal fight to enshrine gender equality in the U.S. Constitution. But first, we're joined by Bay Area sports reporter and frequent guest Steve Berman. He's a staff editor and writer with The Athletic, and we're glad to have him with us tonight to break down the 49ers' exciting win yesterday and help us get pumped for the year ahead in sports here in 2026. So welcome back to State of the Bay, Steve.
Thanks for having me again, Ethan. A lot going on right now.
It's a good time to have you on. Let's start with the big sports win for the Bay Area, the 49ers. It was a pretty thrilling game yesterday. So I'm curious, what did their win tell you about who this team is and how dangerous they could potentially be now heading into the NFC divisional round?
Yeah, I think it told me that I have no idea what's going on in this season whatsoever. At this point, I think everyone is sort of like, how the heck did this happen? If you look at the defense especially, you're talking about a bunch of guys who weren't even on the team until like a few weeks ago or even less time than that, especially on the linebacker side. The defensive line looks nothing like what they had planned. And then George Kittle tears his Achilles. He's one of the heart and souls of the team along with Fred Warner. And then they still end up winning. It's not a good look for Nick Sirianni and the Eagles, who seemed like they were kind of broken the entire season. But conversely, you could tell early in the season that there was a much better vibe with this team, even though they had cut so much salary and it looked like on paper that they lost so much talent. I never heard Kyle Shanahan seem so optimistic going into a season. Usually he sort of plays it straight. This year, even with all the departures, he was so happy about the team getting younger and the guys that they brought in. It seems like they really targeted character guys and guys who lay it all out on the line for the team instead of being individuals this year. Another thing I noticed, too, after the Bears win, Christian McCaffrey afterwards just kept talking about how much he loves the team and how much they all love each other. And when you're missing your top two receivers going into the year, Pearsall and Brandon Ayuk, who never played, and all these other players, Bosa and Warner and Mykal Williams, their first-round pick, and they can still do this, now just everything is on the table. There's no dominant team in the NFL right now. There's no real Super Bowl favorite. It's going to be tough going into Seattle on a short week, but man, at this point now, counting out this team just seems like a fool's errand.
It does seem like they're playing with a lot of heart, given all the injuries. And I'm curious what you make of these injuries. I've seen some stats that the Niners are the most injury-prone team in the NFL over the last 10 years. There are social media rumors that there's electromagnetic field from a nearby substation next to where they play. That might be an explanation. I mean, people are really grasping at some straws here. Why are the Niners so injury-riddled? What's going on here?
A lot of it, I think, is the way they play. They're a team that has been known for years where when you played them, you got beat up. They play a physical style of football on both sides, offense and defense. They're going to knock you around. So I think that's part of it. Another thing that one of my coworkers, Matt Barrows, great beat writer for The Athletic, has brought up, the 49ers actually practice harder than pretty much every team in football. And that includes training camp, especially. Kyle is not someone who's trying to hide people from injury. And I think that at times it comes back to bite him. They also are a little bit too optimistic, it seems, at times with injury recovery. They'll have guys who are coming off of stuff and they're like, oh yeah, you should be back by a certain period. Then next thing you know, they either come back and get injured right away or they're out much longer because the 49ers are way too optimistic about a recovery timeline. So I think all that kind of stuff comes into play. But then you look at what happened with the Eagles. They rested all their starters in the last game of the regular season, and then they came out and were pretty flat yesterday. I don't know if the reason why it was because they rested their starters, but the Niners didn't, and they ended up coming through in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, it looked like the Eagles had a bit of a meltdown, but that's yesterday's news, and now the Niners got to look forward to, as you said, a short week. They're playing Saturday against Seattle, a team that final score didn't reflect it, but it looked like they beat them pretty handily. when they were battling out for the number one seed in the NFC. What is it going to take for the 49ers to play differently against Seattle on Saturday?
When he asked that question, I go back to the Juwan Jennings play yesterday. After that first drive where DeMarcus Robinson had a nice little first punch with that 62-yard catch, the longest play of the entire season, actually, which shows that they haven't really been as explosive as in previous years. But after that play, it really did look like the Eagles were just going to sort of outlast the Niners throughout the rest of the game. In the beginning of the second half, they come out with a trick play. Juwan Jennings, the former high school four-star quarterback, lofts a beautiful pass. I actually joked on social media afterwards, maybe the Jets should sign Juwan Jennings, who's going to be a free agent, to be their next quarterback, because it's not like anything else is working for the Jets. But I think that in terms of that play, and then just the way that they played offense, getting creative, I think that they're just going to be everything out on the table. And this is actually a great spot for them mentally, I think. They're going to be really upset about the short week. They're also just playing with house money. They weren't expected to do anything this year from the start of the season. And so they're going to just hope that Seattle plays tight and just take some chances during this game, like they did on that Juwan Jennings play. Kyle kind of hides those secret special plays, those trick plays for the end of the regular season and the playoffs when he needs them. I think we're going to see some interesting creative stuff. And, you know, Kyle seems like he's having a lot of fun. There's no pressure on him this year. Now it's just sort of like, all right, let's just have fun and beat these guys and do something that no one expects us to do.
Yeah. All right. So you heard it here first. Juwan Jennings, starting quarterback for the New York Jets.
That's right.
Pick him up on your fantasy team. Well, we can talk a lot more about the 49ers, but I want to turn to the Golden State Warriors. This has been kind of another roller coaster season with a lot of inconsistency. They've shown flashes of championship level play, but then there have been these losing streaks and seeming disarray on the team. At this point, do you see them as a legitimate playoff threat?
Well, I don't see them as a title threat as currently constructed. They look like they're heading towards a very familiar spot for them, the play-in tournament. And we'll see, though. I mean, it's kind of bunched up in the middle, and it's the Kuminga thing. It's been talked about for way too long. I think everyone's kind of tired of it, but it's still there. I mean, Kuminga is still on the team, and he's not playing at all. Kerr's done. He's not in the rotation anymore. I don't know if they're just hiding him just to make sure that he doesn't get injured so that they can trade him on January 15th when he's eligible to be traded after signing that restricted free agent deal. But at this point now, for one, they need another scorer. That's, you know, A1. It would be nice to get a little bit more size since everyone's getting bigger and the Warriors are still one of the smaller teams and one of the older teams and one of the least athletic teams. They still have Steph, who's still just transcendent and awesome. The Warriors still have it in them to play great basketball at times, and they're relatively healthy right now, so they don't really have any excuses. It just seems like this Kuminga divorce has been protracted, and it's sort of a black cloud over the team. That needs to be figured out. And not only that, they have to get someone who's better, who can get in the rotation in order for them to play to a level of a top four team in the West. And that's the other thing, too. I mean, Steph, Draymond, Jimmy, these guys are older. Can they stay healthy for the second half as they make a push? It's going to be tough. I mean, if you're betting on it, you know, you're not going to be betting on the Warriors advancing past maybe the first round of the playoffs. But you never know. This Kuminga thing is really where everything's in the balance.
You mentioned Curry getting older. Of course, he's a Bay Area legend. How much longer can the Warriors continue to try to build a team around him?
That's the million-dollar question. A lot of it depends on if he can keep playing at this level. It seems like he can. He doesn't have any sort of injury issues right now. It seems like at this point, you have to just keep rolling with this as long as he is an elite all-NBA player. The big question to me is Steve Kerr going to be around next year? He's been a lame duck coach the entire season. Joe Lacob had an interesting scenario earlier this season where he fan emailed him with frustration about the team. And then Lacob sent him an email back saying that, oh, it's style of play and coaches with liking certain players. And trust me, I'm as frustrated as you are. And then that fan leaked the email right afterwards. And it wasn't really painting a great picture of the relationship between Lacob and Kerr, which I'm sure has had ups and downs the entire time that Kerr has been there anyway. But is Kerr going to stick around? And then if he doesn't after this year, which I think is quite possible, who's coming in and what does that mean? some point you're going to pay the piper and you're going to have some lean years coming up.
Yeah. So we'll see. And I think it's probably the last time Joe Lacob is going to email anything back to a fan. All right, let's talk about the San Francisco Giants. They've got a new manager now coming in from college baseball. How do you think Tony Vitello is going to fare in the big leagues, and how is he going to be managing a relationship with Buster Posey to position the team for the playoffs in 2026 here?
Yeah, Posey and Tony Vitello, I think, are not going to be an issue at all because he targeted Vitello early on, I think. Giants, not on paper, the best team going in the season. They haven't done an incredible amount to bolster the roster, and that's obviously the most important thing. They're banking on Vitello to give them some sort of energy, spark, and swagger that they didn't have before. The question now is, how is that going to relate to a team with some veterans? You know, you got Matt Chapman, Rafael Devers, Willie Adames, Logan Webb is still in his 20s, but he's been around a long time. He's, I think, the longest tenured Giant right now. He has some strong personalities, not difficult personalities, but it's going to be interesting to see how Vitello deals with a completely different type of roster, guys of different statures and ages, and also from different cultures. You know, college baseball in Tennessee, in the SEC, a little bit different from the major leagues, where you have people coming in from all different types of countries, and a lot of them speak Spanish. He's trying to build out a coaching staff, I think, that can help him with that. It's going to be interesting. So during spring training, our league guy for the Giants, Andrew Baggerly, he's going to be there for a long time just because we don't know what a Tony Vitello spring training even looks like. What are the drills even going to look like? How is he going to interact with everybody? You know, how is this going to be different? So we want to get a real good sort of finger on the pulse of what this is because we haven't seen it. No team has hired someone from college baseball straight to the majors. And even he admitted he doesn't know how it's going to go.
Yeah, it'll be a bit of an experiment. Maybe it'll go well and it'll be the start of a new wave of coaches coming in, or you know, we'll see. Maybe it won't work out, but it'll be interesting to watch regardless. Let's talk about one of the feel-good stories from 2025 in the Bay Area sports scene, and that's the Valkyries in their inaugural season. They sold out Chase Center for every regular season home game. They finished with a winning record, and they became the first WNBA expansion franchise to make the playoffs in year one. Do you think they're going to be able to build on that early success?
Or is there going to be a season? I mean, that's the number one question right now. I think for sure if they can get this CBA thing figured out, and obviously the players, rightfully so, in my opinion, are digging in because you can tell that the revenue is up and it's only going to get higher. I mean, just look at the Valkyries as a lead example. That is not a cheap place to go watch a game. And I priced Valkyries tickets throughout the season. Not cheap. And that place sold out, and it didn't just sell out. It was loud. And think of how much merch they were selling. So that team already is the most valuable WNBA franchise in the entire league, I believe. Natalie Nicasse, I think, is an outstanding coach. She did exactly what you should do when you get an expansion team where your first round pick stays in Europe, doesn't even play for you the entire year. You got a bunch of sixth and seventh players from other teams. Just defense, you know, that team's defense was incredible from pretty much the week one of the season. And defense travels, and defense doesn't go up and down like three-point shooting or offense or what have you. So I think Natalie Nicasse is an up-and-coming coach, and the team's only going to get better once everything opens up, and because they will open up. There's too much money to be made. They're going to get something figured out. And I know Joe Lacob is really into making this thing good real quick. So they'll just keep getting better. And honestly, I think Nicasse is a rising star. And with her and the defense they already started with, that's a foundation that doesn't go away. So yeah, I think the Valkyries, once the season starts, hopefully it starts on time, are just going to keep getting better and better.
I think it is very exciting what's going on with the Valkyries. And we'll, like I say, just keep our fingers crossed on that. Well, last question before I let you go. Beyond the teams that we've talked about, are there other Bay Area sports teams or storylines that you're following or particularly excited about for the year ahead here?
I think it's pretty interesting that the Sharks are already looking like they could be a playoff team. And Macklin Celebrini, we saw it last year as a rookie. He's actually Rick Celebrini, the Warriors head trainer's son, is just a fantastic player. I think there were some questions when he was the number one overall pick, is he going to be as dominant as some number one overall picks just because he's not as physically imposing as some of the ones in recent years, but man, his IQ is off the charts. He's a glorious passer. He can score. He's also tough. He puts his nose in everything. He's not one of those guys who just scores the goals and lets an enforcer come and knock other guys around. And the Sharks have a lot of other good young players, you know, Will Smith and a bunch of others. So they used to be in contending for the Stanley Cup Finals every year during the Marleau and Thornton years and Pavelski. And then they just completely died. I went to one Sharks game as a fan last year, just watching celebrating in the ice. He just looks different. You know, I mean, sort of like when Steph was a rookie and you're just like, wait, there's something here. If you get these ankles right, there's something here. I think Celebrini is going to be one of those guys to where the Sharks actually take off and really start winning here, which I think will happen in the next couple of years. I think we're going to see a lot more kids walking around with Celebrini jerseys on.
All right. Well, it's a great story to keep in mind. We're going to have to leave it there. Steve Berman, staff editor and writer with The Athletic. Thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay and giving us a great preview of what's to come in 2026 in the Bay Area sports scene.
Absolutely. Anytime, Ethan. Thanks for having me on.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll discuss the pros and cons of adopting congestion pricing in San Francisco. That's right after the break, so stay with us.
Every week, KALW's Bay Made features one local independent podcast or producer. This week, we're sharing episodes of A Tiny Plot, a documentary series that follows a group of people who are unhoused in Oakland as they fight to build a community of their own on land from the city. So tune into Bay Made this Monday through Thursday at 11:30 a.m. right here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, Bay Area.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. 3 years after a major flood, residents are still recovering.
The people who decided to take that risk were the developers, the city, and the county who knew that there was a possibility of this in this place.
Seeking accountability. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. A year after New York City rolled out congestion pricing, charging drivers to enter parts of Lower Manhattan, early results point to safer streets, faster commutes, and new funding for public transit. So that experience has renewed interest in whether congestion pricing could be a tool for other cities, including here in San Francisco. Versions of congestion pricing have been studied and floated in our city for decades, but they've never gained much traction. The most recent proposal was tabled after the pandemic hit, when traffic and downtown activity had already ground to a halt. But now New York's experience has revived this conversation. Supporters are arguing that congestion pricing could reduce traffic, it could cut emissions, help shore up transit funding altogether. So critics warn it would raise costs for working people, slow downtown recovery, and potentially solve a problem that doesn't really exist in San Francisco. So the question is now the right time for San Francisco to seriously consider adopting a congestion pricing plan? To help us dig into that debate, I'm very pleased to welcome Zach Deutsch-Gross. He's executive director of Transform, an Oakland-based nonprofit focused on sustainable transportation and affordable housing. Welcome to State of the Bay, Zach.
Thanks, Ethan. Pleasure to be on.
And we also are welcoming Griffin Lee, who works on community engagement with the moderate grassroots political organization Connected SF. Welcome to State of the Bay, Griffin.
Thanks so much, Ethan. Pleasure to be here.
And of course, we want you, our listeners, to be a part of this conversation. So we're going to be discussing whether congestion pricing makes sense for San Francisco, and we would love to hear your questions, your thoughts, your opinions about whether or not this would be a good idea for San Francisco. How would congestion pricing in downtown San Francisco potentially affect you? You can give us a call. The phone lines are open early at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And you can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on social media. We'll be monitoring our social media accounts as well during this segment. So, Zach, let me start with you. Why do you think congestion pricing is something that San Francisco should seriously consider right now?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And I think, you know, we've learned from the experience in New York. We've finally got a firsthand example of what this could look like. We don't have to look to European examples anymore. But The simple answer is that less congestion leads to more foot traffic, safer streets, and a stronger local economy.
And what problem exactly would congestion pricing be solving that our current policies aren't already addressing?
You know, there's a number of problems that congestion pricing can help us address. But, you know, I have a one-year-old son. I live in San Francisco. So for me, the number one problem is safety. And the fact that on average, 33 people die every year from traffic violence in San Francisco alone is a fundamental problem that we need to address. And when we have less driving, when we have sustainable options like public transit, walking, and biking, we have safer streets. And we can get into other things. It's good for equity. It's better for local businesses. It supports our transit system, and it's better for air quality. But I think fundamentally, we want people to be able to get around safely and reliably, and congestion pricing helps us get there.
And Griffin Lee, let me turn to you and hear your side of this story here. What's your fundamental objection to congestion pricing in San Francisco?
Certainly. San Francisco and the San Francisco Municipal Transit Agency need to balance the needs of San Franciscans. Current state and reality is that only more than half of the population rely on their cars on a day-to-day basis to get from point A to point B. Whereas, say, for example, and I will call it out, everyday cyclists, only 3% of residents of San Francisco cycle every day. So my core objection, though, is, yeah, one, balancing the needs of the residents, not running and pushing an agenda that eliminates cars. The reality is also that San Francisco does not have the transit system that New York City does and Manhattan. San Francisco office attendance as of December 2025 remains stalled at 40-45% of pre-pandemic levels, with vacancies still hovering 33-35%. If we're going to introduce congestion pricing, that is not welcoming back business. That is actually the dire opposite, and we need to actually get creative and get recruiting if we want to bring downtown back. Not congestion pricing.
And Griffin, I'm sure you've been following some of the results from New York. It seems like foot traffic has been up there. So I'm wondering if you think congestion pricing can work in some context, but just not in San Francisco, or if you're just opposed to it in general.
I think when it comes to foot traffic in New York City, I think especially, you know, downtown financial district, they've had success converting office to residential. San Francisco has been at this discussion for 3 years now, and we haven't seen one office building get converted to residential apartments. So I think it's more about, again, clean streets and recruiting business back to San Francisco should be number one priority before any other things related to downtown. For example, like the Westfield Mall. I mean, that's going to bring foot traffic back if we find a university to occupy that space, or get creative with experiential type opportunities for people to have an incentive to come downtown.
Zach,
can I jump in there for a second, Ethan?
Let me go back to you, Zach. Go ahead, Zach. Yeah, we'll give you a quick chance to respond. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry about that. No, it not only is foot traffic up in New York, but 2024 was the best leasing year for 23 years in Manhattan. So, and sales tax receipts were up over 6%. So, Griffin, I would argue that congestion pricing has actually helped local businesses and helped revitalize the downtown. I'm game for redeveloping the Westfield area as well. But I think at the end of the day, congestion pricing is a win-win. It's better for drivers as well, and it's better for businesses, it's better for pedestrians, and it's better for our economy.
I'll state one more thing, and I appreciate that sentiment, Zach. Always happy to have an open dialogue. I will state, the anti-car rhetoric in San Francisco, example, car-free market, which originated right before the pandemic, has absolutely decimated downtown. and especially mid-market, has no cars allowed on market been the sole reason for a lack of business in downtown or mid-market? Absolutely not. But you have to allow residents choice, not run an agenda.
All right, well, we're speaking with Zach Deutsch-Gross, Executive Director of Transform, an Oakland-based nonprofit focused on sustainable transportation and affordable housing, and Griffin Lee, who works on community engagement with the moderate grassroots political organization Connected SF. And we're debating whether or not San Francisco should bring congestion pricing to its downtown, building off of what New York City implemented a year ago. I'm Ethan Elkind. You're listening to State of the Bay, and the phone lines are open. Would congestion pricing in downtown San Francisco affect you? Would you welcome fewer cars into the city, or are you worried that it could hurt a downtown that's still struggling to recover, as we were just describing there? The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We had a number of emails come in, an email from Chance. Chance writes, San Francisco is already a leader in transit access and active mobility. Why do we need congestion pricing as well? Zach, your thoughts in response to Chance's question.
Well, I think congestion pricing complements our existing infrastructure in San Francisco. And like Griffin, that's infrastructure for cars as well as for walking, biking, and public transit. So congestion pricing gives people the choice of paying a little bit more for additional access to downtown, but for a worry-free, easy commute, while also giving us revenue to reinvest in a better public transit system. You know, I grew up riding Muni my whole life, born and raised in the Mission. I live in Ingleside now. I love the 29 and the 14, but yeah, I'd love a 29 Rapid. And that could be a thing that San Francisco gets if we invest in congestion pricing. So we've got a great transit system now. We need to pass a transit funding measure, two transit funding measures to keep that system going in 2026. But I see congestion pricing as a complementary piece that allows us to continue to improve and grow our entire transportation system for everyone in the Bay Area. Especially San Franciscans.
And on that subject of funding transit, another email from Jake who writes, we've seen great results from New York's congestion pricing plan, even with the reduced fare. Do you see a realistic path towards accomplishing something similar in San Francisco? We're facing a funding crisis with SFMTA and serious parking and traffic problems downtown. So I think it could be a great fit here. But since we don't have the same transit rideshare as New York City, I worry it would be hard to get the political support. Griffin, let me direct that question to you first. We just heard Zach talk about the funding crisis for MTA, for Muni transit in the city. If we don't do congestion pricing, aren't we potentially undermining the fiscal picture for transit that our downtown is also going to be dependent on?
And when it comes to the fiscal crisis, I think the majority of residents are tired of being squeezed. That's the reality. And we saw that with Prop L last year. It did not pass, which was the measure to fund Muni. Fund the bus was their tagline. We believe at Connected SF that there can be more cost-cutting and internal efficiencies that would not affect transit operations today. Secondly, there have been various initiatives over the course of the last decade with SFMTA that has not been fully focused on Muni. There is over 60% of administrative staff increase in the last 3 years, not dating back to last year, 22, 23, 24. In their charter, there goes nothing to state about safety. Their number one critical piece in the charter is transit. Yet you go to their board meetings and they don't even focus, they don't focus solely on transit. And so I think there are opportunities to optimize transit as is today, and that doesn't necessarily have the meaning to squeeze more money out of residents of San Francisco, because we've seen time and time over again that MTA wants to squeeze more money out of the residents. Just look at the history in elections and sources tied to transportation initiatives and measures.
Yeah, Zach, let me get your response to Griffin's points there.
Yeah, a couple things just to clarify. Griffin, Prop L, that actually passed with a majority, passed with a majority in San Francisco. It didn't get the didn't beat Measure M, but a majority of San Franciscans supported funding transit and will continue to. I also want to say that, like, you know, I agree with you. We need to be investing in public transit. We need to be holding SFMTA accountable. I've been at the same SFMTA meetings you have to make sure that they are investing in riders and investing in all of San Franciscans. The way we do that is we make sure we give them the resources to succeed. That means supporting Mayor Lurie's parcel tax this November to fund SFMTA and to fund our vital transit systems. And so, Griffin, I look forward to your organization continuing to support that, if you do, and making sure that we are investing in our transit system. Because, you know, the safest transportation system in the Bay Area and San Francisco is one where people don't have to drive.
All right, let's go to the phone lines.
I appreciate
Griffin, let me take a caller here, because we've got David from San Francisco calling in from Bernal Heights. David, welcome to State of the Bay.
Good evening.
Good evening to you. What are your thoughts about congestion pricing?
Well, I like small increments of change, which congestion pricing would achieve. Possibly we'd see, we should experiment. I'm up with that. But I'm looking at the big vision. I'm a big fan of land value taxation. It's not going to happen anytime soon, but a real earnest effort to move in that direction. If you don't know what land value taxation is, it's saying that the value added by public transportation to location values, that should be retrieved to pay for that transportation. So it's relating the value added by public transportation to the revenue for the city, if you follow that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that thought about a potential alternative approach to funding some of our vital services. Zach, I'll go to you first on that. What are your thoughts in response to David's point about getting a land value tax conversation going if not fully implemented?
Yeah, you know, we need to be exploring different ways to fund public transportation in the Bay Area and in San Francisco. A land value tax is certainly one of those options. I think we're a little bit farther along when it comes to congestion pricing. You know, we have an example in New York of what real success looks like. And we've, you know, Ethan, as you started this conversation off, we've been talking about congestion pricing for over 15 years. And so I think that congestion pricing is a little further on as a piece of that solution, but I think we need to stay in dialogue and be imagining how we fund our transportation system, particularly in light of, you know, a federal government that is not likely to be supporting transit anytime soon.
And Griffin Lee from Connected SF, any thoughts in response to the land value tax comment?
I think as of right now, current state, at least myself and staff at Connected SF, we would have opposed probably any tax coming out of that nature. One point on I wanted to make with Zach, where we could, I think SFMTA could actually shore up and optimize transit routes today. There are currently 27 routes that MTA runs that is either less than 50% or in between 50 and 80% of recovery from 2019. So that's roughly 25 lines that are less than 80%. Why isn't there a proactive opportunity or initiative part of the transit agency is taking to identify where they can maybe add that extra line that Zach's referencing, the express? I think there is demand potentially for more of the express to come back, and I think there is opportunity to do so within the current budget.
So let's go to another email. This one is from Dave in Richmond, who writes, in addition to pressure from the car dealer lobby, I recall one of Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York's reasons for delaying the start of congestion pricing in New York was losing support from car-reliant commuters who live outside of Manhattan. So how can San Francisco advance a more equitable system and ensure that low-income residents who need a car to get to work in the city will not be overburdened by the cost increase? And Zach Deutsch-Gross, executive director of Transforms, is your proponent of bringing congestion pricing to San Francisco. How do you respond to that equity question for those low-income drivers who need to get into the city? Is this going to have a disproportionately negative impact on those types of drivers in our community?
Thanks, and I appreciate that question from one of your listeners. You know, we have to get equity right, both for drivers and for riders in this program. A couple things that New York did that I want to call out that absolutely need to happen as San Francisco moves forward with congestion pricing is a discount program for lower income drivers, as well as for folks who live in the congestion zone, right? So if you're living downtown and you're going to need to get around the city and cross through that zone, you should get a discount. Similarly, for low-income drivers and drivers with disabilities, right? So we need to make sure that the structure includes discount for those who need to drive and don't have other options. But let's also talk about where that revenue goes. Transit riders and folks without a car are more likely to be low-income, and so revenues generated from congestion pricing that go into improving bus and transit service in San Francisco benefit the people with the least amount ability to pay. So we need to think, when we think about equity, we want to think about what is the program structure, where is the revenue going, and then who's at the table. Let's make sure that communities from across the city are consulted and empowered to weigh in on how we get the best congestion pricing plan possible.
All right, if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. We're discussing whether or not San Francisco should adopt congestion pricing, and you can join us to enter this debate and give us your thoughts about whether or not you think congestion pricing is a good idea. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we're joined tonight by Zach Deutsch-Gross, Executive Director of Transform, who is in favor of congestion pricing for downtown San Francisco, and Griffin Lee, who works on community engagement with the moderate grassroots political organization Connected SF. And we have another caller. We have Starchild dialing in. Starchild, welcome to State of the Bay. What are your thoughts on congestion pricing or your questions about congestion pricing?
Oh, thank you for taking the call. I'm chair of the Libertarian Party of San Francisco, by the way, lpsf.org. My thoughts are that whenever they have policy options like this before the public, it's always kind of presented as, well, if you want better services, or even if you want to just keep existing services, you know, we need more money and we want to get that from the public one way or another. They never talk about cutting like the six-figure salaries at City Hall. You know, I know there's people at SFMTA making very good money. You know, I think government should be about giving back to the public, community service, not, you know, a market value way to make a living. It should really be about giving back to the community. Mm-hmm. And people want better services, but they don't want to be taxed more. It's already unaffordable, especially for poor people trying to live in the city.
Yeah. Thank you, Starchild, for that perspective. Yeah. Zach, your thoughts and response.
Yeah, I understand that. I sympathize. You know, I do want to call out that new SFMTA director Julie Kirschbaum, one of her first things was to let go of some of the folks on her management team to streamline that organization. And they've continued to make investments that make sure there's more, that the service is good, that there are more bus drivers, but less people in management. So I think we need to understand that SFMTA has already done a lot of those cuts to streamline their budget. And the second piece is that, you know, Sir Child, I'd go back to what I just framed out is like, we need to make sure that this program works for low-income folks who drive or take transit. We can do that. But let's do that together. Let's reimagine what San Francisco should be for ourselves and for future generations, and the San Francisco that works for everybody. So I think rather than just saying, no, we shouldn't do this, let's explore how we get it right. Let's make San Francisco that beacon of innovation and mobility innovation for the country.
And Griffin, your thoughts. We got a bunch of callers, so if you could keep it brief in response to Starchild's point and the equity point too, since I didn't give you a chance to respond to that as well.
Yeah, I think Starchild makes a really good point there. I mean, salaries, not including pensions alone, for city employees, it feels more than it probably should be. And I think the MTA has to stop looking at them, has to call back a little bit their mindset around revenue and more about efficiency and where they can actually work within their current budget. A quick stat here, contribution from the general fund since 2010 is up $262 million. That's in just inflation adjusted. And that's with a population that has seen a drop since the pandemic. We're still roughly 40,000 residents down from pre-pandemic levels to about 820,000 people. So in regards to, again, to Starchild's point, I think he's onto something there.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phone lines. We have Paul dialing in. Paul, welcome to State of the Bay. Your thoughts on congestion pricing?
Yes, I'm a retired muni operator for 33 years. I can tell you people are not going to take public transit downtown because they don't feel safe. When the muni takes safety on the equipment seriously, you'll get more riders. People are going to drive down there, take Lyft, Uber, cabs. So let's stop this myth that muni is safe at night because people don't feel that way. And I know, because I know a lot of operators, and I've even driven a bus at night.
Yeah, though, thank you, Paul, for your experience and for dialing in with that comment. Zach, I'll let you respond first, and then Griffin, you can weigh in as well.
Yeah, so a quick plug, Transform released a report 2 years ago called Ride Fearlessly about how we can improve safety on transit. That's at transformca.org. We absolutely need to make sure that people feel safe on transit. But, you know, I've been riding muni for over 30 years. I think safety has improved on transit. So I want to, that doesn't mean we can't get better. That doesn't mean we absolutely need to keep supporting our operators. And the increase in assaults on operators we saw during the pandemic was incredibly alarming. But again, let's reinvest. Let's make the system better rather than just beating up on a vital piece of San Francisco.
And Griffin, your thoughts?
Making the system better doesn't necessarily correlate to safer muni. I'm a transit rider myself, not every day, but I do take muni in the bus. I think it's off and on, and I think it's very dependent on the lines you take. I totally hear the sentiment that muni isn't safe, and the people that feel that way. I think my biggest call out and where SFMTA can start is closely partnering with PD on cleaning up bus shelters. There's a lot of bus shelters that you see that the shelters being used for drugs and homeless people, not riders using those shelters, which deters ridership because people don't want to, get on the bus if they see that type of stuff. Secondly, I think fare box evasion is a big one. MTA has started the work on this a little bit this past year. They've seen some, I think, decent results. But there's got to be stricter penalty for fare box evasion. And I actually have suggested at MTA board meetings over the past couple of months to implement maybe experiment on a couple lines, allowing riders to only go through the front door. Yeah. I know the immediate reaction to that is, oh, it's going to slow down transit. Well, that might be the only way to keep people accountable and paying.
Well, Griffin, I hate to interrupt you here. I think you were just wrapped up, but unfortunately we're out of time. I just want to thank you both, and I want to thank the callers who dialed in. Griffin Lee with Connected SF and Zach Deutsch-Gross, Executive Director of Transform. Thank you both so much for joining us and really starting this conversation on congestion pricing.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Ethan.
Thanks, Ethan. Really appreciate it.
And coming up after this break, we're going to talk to filmmaker Deborah Riley Draper about her new documentary, Ratified, which traces the legal, political, and deeply personal fight to enshrine gender equality in the U.S. Constitution. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your vibe curator and selector. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
And I rise up, I'll rise like the day. I rise unafraid, I rise up, and I do it 1,000 times again.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. This is Grace Wong. Tonight, we're speaking with award-winning filmmaker Deborah Riley Draper about her new documentary, Ratified, which traces a century-long fight to add gender equality to the U.S. Constitution. Her film brings together history, activism, and the often overlooked leadership of Black women who have carried this movement across generations. Deborah, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Oh, well, we're excited to have you. And why don't you start with the opening of your film? It follows activists in Virginia pushing to become the crucial 38th state needed to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, which feels like a real throwback. I think it's been decades since we've really thought about the ERA. Tell us, remind us what the Equal Rights Amendment does.
First off, if you go and ask 100 people on the streets around the Bay, are equal rights enshrined in the Constitution? Are women included? Everyone's going to say, yes, of course, duh. But actually, women are not mentioned in the Constitution, and equal rights based on gender is not addressed. So what the Equal Rights Amendment does is it says, by law, we must extend equal rights to everyone and including all genders.
Well, this is a concept that it's been around for 100 years, but really in the 1970s, a bill went through Congress to begin the ratification process. What happened?
Well, you need 38 states to ratify it. They were really, really close in the 70s. They got an extension. And even with the extension, they couldn't get the last three states. So it died.
Mm.
And there were little false starts to try to restart it. But it wasn't until 2017 that the women said, you know what? We are getting too many signals, too many signs that if we don't stand up and say as women, we want to be included in the Constitution, our entire political existence will be erased. And so there became this great big push in the state of Virginia. And before Virginia could ratify, you know, Nevada did, Illinois did, and there was one more slot needed. The 38th state would, by law, ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And all that would be needed would be that it would be enshrined in the Constitution. So Virginia decided. There was a small group of very active women that realized their power. And they said, we can do this. We can become the 38th state.
What's interesting about the women that you chronicle, they're not all seasoned politicians.
They're right? Women who live in the state of Virginia. Some are politicians, some are moms, some are entrepreneurs, some never understood what lobbying and advocacy could be on a local level, even within a neighborhood level, but they understood that they had a voice and that together when they mobilized, that they had the power of this singular voice.
What's rather shocking when you watch the documentary is seeing women who in the 21st century saying, I support equal rights. I don't support this amendment. I don't want it enshrined in the Constitution that there should be equal rights based on gender. And tell us a little bit about the arguments that women are making against ERA.
Well, there were a lot of arguments made against equal rights. And a lot of the arguments were tied to anti-LGBTQ plus rights, right? Mm. So this was, does everyone get to be equal or just some women get to be equal? Will this mean everyone has to go to the same bathroom and every single restaurant? You know, all of these things that have nothing to do with the real issue, which is I am a person, and as a person, I want the same rights as a white male. Mm. Period.
Well, your film Ratified highlights the often overlooked role of Black women in driving this movement. You know, this is all happening in the wake of Donald Trump's first election. Tell me a little bit about that leadership and the difference it made in this pursuit.
Well, I think since for the past 100 years, the visible leaders of the Equal Rights Amendment have been white women. And white women, like white men, segregated themselves away from other women of color. So their movement was restricted in participation. And in the 60s and 70s, as Black power and civil rights really began to illustrate the power of Black women in the political arena, in the local arena, and the ability to mobilize and the ability to get things done politically, this opened up the opportunity for Black women to begin to step into the space with white women to say, we women, we Asian women, we Hispanic women, we Black women, we white women, we women want to be equal. And in Virginia is a very traditional state. Virginia was the head of the Confederacy. Mm. So being able to say, our state looks like an array of people, and this array of people together can really make a big difference. And these Black women who operate in this space of having to understand gender bias and race bias bring so much knowledge, system knowledge, to the understanding of this issue and how to move this issue forward, that it makes complete sense that the spark plug in Virginia would be these women of color, that the jet fuel would be these women that understood how this colony operated from the very beginning and understood how and with whom they could ally in order to move this into being the 38th state.
Well, as a documentary filmmaker, you have access to so much research, and I know you put hours and hours of research into this. And
years.
You read it, right? And it's a rich history of women fighting for hundreds of years for equal rights. And I wonder, as you distilled this, what historical moments did you keep going back to, or did you find were touchstones as you pulled your film together?
Barbara Jordan in 1977, her speech about equality and fighting and the fact that we have to make our America the best America, and it's our responsibility, each of us. That speech, I was like, yeah, that's right. And as a Black congresswoman at that time from the state of Texas in the 70s, what grit, resilience, and perseverance she had to have just to get through law school to get to that place. And her optimism and her hope and her fortitude were just incredible to watch. I kept watching that clip over and over again. And every time I watched it, I just felt so invigorated and so proud to show the clip, so proud to include the clip and hopeful that the impact of the film and that clip in particular would engage people and inspire people to take action for their communities, for themselves, for their families, in understanding that a community is better when we have the benefit of diverse thinking and so many people bringing great ideas to the table.
Mm, well, where is ERA right now?
Well, right now, the ERA is gearing up. At the end of the film, this is a bit of a spoiler alert, but at the end of the film, the Biden administration declares the ERA law, but it had not been enshrined into the Constitution. The current administration is not going to enshrine it. So the women are gearing up to fight.
Tell us where we can see your film.
The film is available on PBS. You can check your local PBS station for the times that it's airing, or you can go to the PBS app and check it out as well.
Well, that's all we have time for tonight. And for our listeners to learn more about Ratified, as Deborah says, you can go to the PBS website or go to www.ratifythefilm.com. Deborah Riley Draper, thank you so much for joining us tonight and for sharing your insights about your film.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We're off next week for Martin Luther King Day, but join us again in 2 weeks. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast so you never miss an episode. And for more information about this and other shows from State of the Bay, visit our page on kalw.org and email us if you have any questions or comments or show ideas, stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show is produced by Chris Nooney and Katie Colley. The show is engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.